You do not have to be good. You do not have to walk on your knees for 100 miles through the desert repenting. You only have to let the soft animal of your body love what it loves. Tell me about despair, yours, and I'll tell you mine. Meanwhile, the world goes on. Meanwhile, the sun and the clear pebbles of the rain are moving across the landscapes, over the prairies and the deep trees, the mountains and the rivers. Meanwhile, the wild geese, high in the clean blue air, are heading home again. Whoever you are, no matter how lonely, the world offers itself to your imagination, calls to you like the wild geese, harsh and exciting, over and over, announcing your place in the family of things.
Come into this place of peace and let its silence heal your spirit. Come into this place of memory and let its history warm your soul. Come into this place of prophecy and power and let its vision change your heart. It's a sacred time. Let us begin in song.
And now, if you'll join me in the responsive reading, number 530. Out of the stars. Out of the stars in their flight, out of the dust of eternity, here have we come. Stardust and sunlight mingling through time and through space. Out of the stars have we come, up from time. Out of the stars have we come. Time out of time before time, in the vastness of space, Earth spun to orbit the sun. Earth, with the thunder of mountains newborn, the boiling of seas. Earth, warmed by sun, lit by sunlight. This is our home. Out of the stars have we come. Mystery hidden in mystery, back through all time. Mystery rising from rocks in the storm and the sea. Out of the stars, rising from rocks in the sea. Kindled by sunlight on earth. Arose life. Ponder this thing in your heart. Ponder with awe. Out of the sea to the land, out of the shallows, came ferns. Out of the sea to the land, up from darkness to light, rising to walk and to fly, out of the sea trembled life. Ponder this thing in your heart. Life up from sea. Eyes to behold, throats to sing, mates to love.
Light from the sea, warmed by sun, washed by rain, light from within, giving birth, rose to love.
This is the wonder of time. This is the marvel of space. Out of the stars swung the earth. Life upon earth rose to love. This is the marvel of life, rising to see and to know. Out of your heart, cry wonder, sing everything.
At the center of our service and in the center of our lives, let us take time to honor the quieter moments in life. You may take these first few moments to light candles of memory and hope, or just to sit quietly, remembering who you are and why you are here. In an attitude of prayer, we pray for peace in the world, in our country, and in our hearts, by way of logic, intelligence, and reason. We pray for what the Buddha defined as enlightenment, that point in time when we are ready to give up the comforts of our illusions. As we hope for the oppressive structures of orthodoxy to give up their illusions, let us commit to giving up our own. Let us take our own liberal faith seriously enough that we find the courage to question our own points of orthodoxy vigorously. May both religion and science become aware of the truth. May the existence or the non-existence of our souls be secondary to all that can be achieved in the wake of science. May religious orthodoxy not prevent scientific discovery, which may improve the life of millions in this life. May we consider that the soul of humanity supports progress towards curing diseases so that all souls may benefit. The march of human progress cannot be smothered by dogma, politics, or power of any kind. For science is in the service of religion, if authentic religion is in the service of compassion, integrity, and the truth. May logic, intelligence, and reason prevail in service of compassion and human progress. Amen. Your order of service says this is a sermon. It will be more like a talk. A sermon is supposed to provide an uplifting spiritual experience. This talk will have at most a vestigial trace of it. The inspiration for this talk started when I was reading Stephen Hawking's book, A Brief History of Time, From the Big Bang to Black Holes. The book is written for an educated layperson, not a physicist or an astronomer. At the end of the book, there are brief biographies, a couple of pages each, of Galileo Galilei, Isaac Newton, and Albert Einstein. Newton and Einstein were two particularly nasty people. Einstein badly abused his two wives, and Newton never married, had numerous enemies, few friends, all of whom he managed to alienate. Now, I have admonished my fellow worship associates never to use material from one single source. That is called plagiarism. If you quote from multiple sources, then it is called research, and that is okay. So I have researched this talk from other sources, a book from Martin Gardner, who has written extensively about pseudoscience or junk science, encyclopedias, the internet, other books, and several issues of Scientific American. Now back to Isaac Newton. His genius is undisputed. In his 20s and 30s, he invented calculus, discovered the binomial theorem, introduced polar coordinates, proved that white light was the mixture of colors, built the first reflecting telescope, and showed that the same force that causes apples to fall is the same force that guides planets, moons, and comets, and produces tides. Unknown to most people is the other Isaac Newton. He was a devout Anglican, indeed a fundamentalist Anglican. He believed that the world was created in 6 24-hour periods. He believed the story of Noah and the story of the flood. Biblical scholars of his day determined that the world was created in the year 4004 before the Common Era. Newton revised this date, making it 500 years later. Scientists have proven that they were both wrong. Now believe that the world is 10.7 billion years old. Most interesting is the fact that Newton was also an Arian, spelled A-R-I-A-N, with an I, not a Y. Arian with a Y is Hitler's concept of a master race. Arian with an I were followers of Arius, a 4th century philosopher who denied the divinity of Jesus Christ. Now imagine that. You can go back home and tell all your friends that Newton was a closet Unitarian. Now, going back to the Middle Ages or the Dark Ages or the Night of History, as it is also called, most of the populace was illiterate. Only the royalty, nobility, military officers who were the offspring of the previous two, and of course the clergy knew how to read and write. Textbooks, if you may call them that, were manuscripts laboriously copied by monks. And tutors of the privileged young were, of course, the clergy. Anything that conflicted with the scriptures was ignored or suppressed. It was at this time, in 1231 of the Common Era, that a pope, inappropriately called Innocent III, introduced the Inquisition. Its purpose was to wipe out every form of heresy. In the first instance, the victims were a sect that lived in southern France, named the Cathari, from the word, the Greek word that means pure, or Albigenses, because they inhabited in the city of Albi in southern France. Their heresy was that they believed that there were two gods, a god of evil and a god of good, who were in constant battle. This makes more sense to me than the Trinity. This made them deserving of death at the hands of the Pope's armies. Yes, in those days, the Pope did have armies. Most amazing to me is the fact that the Inquisition remained on the books of the Vatican long after the Spanish Inquisition brought torture and death to its highest level. It was finally abolished by Pope Gregory IX in 1834. This was decades after the Bill of Rights was written into the U.S. Constitution. In the year 2000, Pope John Paul II apologized for the sins of Roman Catholics made during the Inquisition. But a commission appointed by the same Pope stated that things weren't really as bad as portrayed. 769 years after the Inquisition was created and 166 years after it was dissolved, the Vatican finally apologizes, but of course with a caveat. It gives new meaning to the expression, things move at the speed of church. A historic evolution occurred with Gutenberg's inventing of the printing press that brought literacy to many beyond those mentioned earlier. It was probably the single most important factor that brought forth the Renaissance. Now we come to Galileo. He was attracted to the Copernican theory that the planets orbited around the sun, orbited the sun, and he found additional evidence to support it. His views were widely accepted in the universities, but the annoyed Aristotelian professors who persuaded the Catholic Church to ban Copernicanism. It's important to note that nowhere in the Bible does it say that the earth is the center of the universe. This was inferred because God created the Garden of Eden on earth, and where else would he create it if it wasn't in the center of the universe? A possible exception to this can be found in the book of Joshua. During the Battle of Jericho, Joshua was leading the Israelite armies against Israel's enemies. As Joshua's men were leading the battle to vanquish the enemy, he found that the sun was about to set, permitting their opponents to retreat during the night and regroup to fight another day. At that point, Joshua commanded the sun to stand still. Note that he didn't command that the earth stop spinning around its axis. So obviously in his mind, the sun orbited around the earth. Worried that the church's opposition to his ideas, Galileo traveled to Rome to speak to the ecclesiastical authorities. He argued that the Bible was not intended to tell us anything about scientific theories and astronomy. That was a very bad idea. The Pope was afraid that this controversy might undermine the efforts to fight Protestantism, so it took repressive measures. It declared Copernicanism a heresy and forced Galileo to recant in the year 1633. 349 years later, in 1992, the Pope John Paul II finally admitted that the Church was the one that had erred. Again, things move at the speed of church. Now, why was Galileo treated so shabbily while Copernicus and Johannes Kepler escaped the wrath of the Vatican? The answer, they lived in Poland and Germany beyond the reach of the ecclesiastical authorities. Galileo was unfortunate to live in the shadow of the Vatican. The punishment for heresy was burning at the stake. Denying the divinity of Jesus Christ or questioning the Trinity was heresy. Michael Servetus and the philosopher Giordano Bruno were burned at the stake for their beliefs. I got to mention that the Vatican didn't have a monopoly on cruelty. Servetus was burned at the stake at the order of Calvin. We move now to Charles Darwin. He wrote The Origin of Species in 1858. Darwin never said that we were descended from monkeys. It is paleontologists reviewing the fossil record that have theorized that humans and apes are descendants from a common ancestor more than 5 million years ago. As with Galileo, Darwin's ideas were warmly received in academic circles. It was the church that opposed his theories. Now, you're all familiar with the monkey trial in Tennessee. In 1925, John Scopes, a high school teacher, was arrested and tried for teaching evolution. The statutes in Tennessee contained the Butler Act that prohibited teaching anything that conflicted with the Bible. This trial attracted national attention, and fearful that the local district attorney was not up to the task, the authorities brought in as prosecuting attorney William Jennings Bryan, a fundamentalist preacher and politician, the only candidate from a major political party to run for president 3 times and be defeated all 3 times. Now, this happened a century ago. Bryan was defeated by three Republican candidates. Can you imagine that? 100 years ago, the fundamentalist was a Democrat. In Scope's defense, Clarence Darrow, a giant in American legal history, took the case pro bono. Darrow, an avowed agnostic, put Brian on the stand as a biblical expert and proceeded to demolish his testimony. Scopes was convicted and fined $200, which was later overturned on a technicality. Brian, a spent man, died 1 week after the trial. Amazingly, the Butler Act remained on the books until 1957. Further vindicating Darwin in 1996, Pope John Paul II stated that evolution is no longer just a theory, but a well-established fact that Catholics should accept, provided they insist that immortal souls were infused into the evolved bodies of the first humans. Again, we see things moving at the speed of church. 108 years after Darwin published The Origin of Species, the church bows to the inescapable fact that science was right and the church was wrong. But surprise, surprise, they do it replacing one dogma with another. We will accept the theory of evolution, but you must accept that God gave humans souls. Now, this presented me with a conundrum. The fossil record shows that Homo sapiens evolved over millions of years. The first hominids, or humanoids, appeared about 5 million years ago in the form of Homo habilis, who could not walk erect but had the ability of making tools. About 1.7 million years ago, the hominids learned how to walk upright and their brains grew. These were Homo erectus. Finally, somewhere between 200 and 300,000 years ago, as their brains grew even larger, they became modern Homo sapiens. Now comes a question that has been bothering me for quite a while. At what point were humans human enough to be given a soul? When did the first soulless hominid couple give birth to a child that had a soul? Now, but did all hominids evolve simultaneously? If not, did some soul-imbued hominid mate with a not-so-evolved hominid? In that case, did their hybrids' offspring have a soul? I haven't got the Pope to answer those questions. It is believed that about 500,000 years ago, Homo erectus branched out into two species, Homo sapiens and Homo neanderthalensis. It is known that the two coexisted in the Neander Valley in Germany, but they did not interbreed. The Neanderthals had only 80% of the brain size of Homo sapiens, and scientists tell us that they became extinct 25,000 years ago. I don't believe that for one moment. Neanderthals with their small brains are alive and well. If you don't believe me, you can go to the Capitol building when the legislature is in session, and you will find them in large numbers. You can also find them in Washington, D.C., and in the capitals of the other 49 states. The late paleontologist Stephen Jay Gould, who died prematurely at age 61 2 years ago, thought that science and religion had mended their differences of centuries and could coexist. He wrote a cleverly titled book, Rock of Ages, in which he said that if the church retains the Rock of Ages and the science the Age of Rocks, there would be no conflict. He also said science determines how the heavens go and religion how to go to heaven. If Gould were alive today, he would see that religion does not want to coexist with science. Today's war is mainly in three fields, all in the reproductive sciences. Catholic theology, as well as that of fundamentalist Christians, most evangelicals and Pentecostals, tell us that every human has a soul. The moment that a human female egg with 23 chromosomes and an X chromosome merges with a male sperm, also with 23 chromosomes and either an X or a Y chromosome, to become a single cell, that cell is a human being and has a soul. For that reason, several religions believe that not only is abortion wrong, but also contraception, in vitro fertilization, and cloning of humans. Here's the first battle in the war between science and religion: the approval of the morning after pill, or also referred to as Plan B. This pill, consisting of large doses of estrogens, if taken within 72 hours of unprotected sex, will in most cases prevent the implantation of the fertilized egg. An outside panel of experts voted by 23-4 to recommend that it be sold over the counter. This angered religious conservatives who, feeling that this would lead to promiscuity and the use by minors, lobbied the FDA to withdraw approval, stating that the FDA, quote, lacked the relevant data on over-the-counter use by young adolescents. All this in spite of the fact that the drug has been available over-the-counter in Sweden and France for many years, with no reports of major adverse effects on adolescents. As in centuries past, politics and religion allied themselves to trump the recommendation of scientists. We now come to the second battlefield. It has to do with embryonic stem cell research. A byproduct of in vitro fertilization is the production of 3 to 5 day old embryos. The fate of these embryos fall in one of these five categories. Number one, they can be implanted into the mother and then evolved into a pregnancy. Number two, they can be frozen for later use. Number three, they can be donated to an infertile couple. Number four, they can be destroyed. Or number five, they can be turned over to scientists who can harvest embryonic stem cells from them. It is generally accepted that adult stem cells do not, I emphasize, do not have the potential of embryonic stem cells to develop into multiple adult tissues. Conservative religions are opposed to the destruction of embryos for beneficial purposes, even if they are to be discarded. Now, a short lesson in biology. After a male sperm fertilizes a female egg to produce the first cell, it will eventually become a human being if implanted and carried to completion. That single cell will divide and multiply, and after 3 to 5 days, it becomes a ball of 120 to 160 cells. The outer layer of small cells becomes the placenta if implanted, and inside that ball are embryonic stem cells that in a few more days will begin to differentiate into all the tissues and organs of the body. In mice, these embryonic stem cells, when cultured in a petri dish, can be coaxed to become certain tissues, among them islet cells that secrete insulin, nerve cells, and cardiac cells. It is interesting to note that although the president opposes providing federal funds to destroy embryos to obtain stem cells, 58 senators, 15 of them Republicans, have urged the president to relax federal restrictions on embryonic stem cell research. Other senators are expected to come forward to join these 58. Nancy Reagan and all of Reagan's children have come forward favoring stem cell research. 48 Nobel laureates have also come out in favor of lifting these restrictions. But the current administration stubbornly prefers to listen to narrow sectarian dictates rather than the opinion of scientists. Indeed, several years ago, three Republican senators campaigned to have all restrictions against embryonic stem cell research lifted. They were the late Senator Strom Thurmond and two devout Mormons from Utah, Orrin Hatch and the former Senator Jake Garn. Now, could it be a coincidence that all three of these gentlemen had either children or grandchildren with type 1 diabetes, where stem cell research offers the most promise? Equally ominously, the Bush administration has ordered that government scientists must be approved by a senior political appointee before they can participate in meetings convened by the World Health Organization. Last April, an official of the Department of Health and Human Services asked the World Health Organization to route any request for participation in its meeting to the Department of Health and Human Services. The secretary should then review rather than directly invite individual scientists, as has long been the case. The World Health Organization wisely refused to implement the request. This is another example of the unholy alliance of church and politics against science. It is indeed a sad and dangerous time when the government would rather impose an ideological litmus test in the selection of individuals rather than the best qualified candidates. Finally, we come to the matter of human cloning, and here we come to a fork in the road. Cloning can be done for therapeutic purpose or reproductive purposes. Even among the scientific community, reproductive human cloning is considered unethical. Animal experience tells us that a large percent of animals cloned this way have congenital anomalies and die prematurely. Therapeutic cloning is, again, an altogether different thing. Now, another brief lesson in biology. Cloning is obtained by removing the nucleus from a female egg and inserting the nucleus of an adult cell, usually a cell from the skin, from another individual. This tricks the female cell to think it has been fertilized and begins to divide as if it had been fertilized the usual way. If this cell is allowed to divide, it becomes the ball of cells previously described. And inside of it, they can find embryonic stem cells that can be coaxed to become islet cells that secrete insulin. The advantage of using these clone cells is that they have the genetic makeup of the donor cell and therefore will not be rejected if they are injected into the same individual. Cloning is easy in theory, but not in practice. An Argentine-born scientist, Jose Cibelli, has done pioneering work in cloning at Michigan State University in East Lansing. Last February, he and Woo-Suk Wang from the Seoul National University in Korea published a paper proving that they had succeeded in cloning a human embryo. Now, why didn't Cibelli do his work in the comfort of his lab in East Lansing? Because there is a law on the books in Michigan that prohibits any form of human cloning. Under these circumstances, Cibelli could have been arrested, tried, and if found guilty, served up to 10 years in prison. Who knows, his cellmate could have been Dr. Jack Kevorkian. Korea, Japan, and Singapore, among other countries, have no restrictions on human cloning for therapeutic purposes. As I said, cloning, human or otherwise, is not an easy thing to accomplish in the lab. The Korean scientists and Cibelli had 242 donated eggs to work with. They were able to experiment with techniques, timing, and conditions at every step. Even so, from hundreds of eggs, the effort yielded only one stem cell line. Now, my time is almost up. History repeats itself. Religious orthodoxy and fundamentalists of all stripes continue trying to impose their beliefs on others. I think I have given you abundant reasons why the interference of religion into scientific matters is alive and well in our country today. Hopefully, the speed of church will pick up and the voice of reason will prevail over narrow sectarian dictates, all for the benefit of humankind.